在做了我给There's other members that don't come here, but I don't think we'll wait for them because time is very precious. And I think there's one thing that we can't control is time. Mm-hmm. So if we wait for time, it doesn't wait for us. By the way, I forgot to say thank you very much for changing your schedule. You were supposed to be in Durban today.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe to finalize your... Your Devon payment and whatnot. So maybe you can blame us for asking you to come here. Thank you for coming, and I hope you have postponed it and they understand.
The chair is right here.
Oh, the chair is right there? Okay. Oh, she's the one who agreed.
No apology.
No, thank you very much for affording us this opportunity. Now it's going to be time for us to ask you questions on what you have. There's only one member. I'm just going to give over to her. I'm not sure whether before you come in, maybe we should not allow Uche just to talk briefly about the case and just to brief us as to what's happening, if it's not confidential, if it's not within the legal... Okay. If you can, just give us a briefing and then we'll put in our questions after that. Okay, it's 10.
Thank you. I will be very careful. Don't worry. Thank you. Now, one of the details.
Okay, yeah.
Principles. Thank you. Good afternoon, members, honorable members, and colleagues from NHLS, and colleagues from health. Chairperson, in brief, what we have been mandated by the minister is to come up with an amicable way of resolving the current conflict. I think it's proper to call it.
Dispute.
Thank you. I was right, looking for a proper word. The dispute which actually ended up in court. So we are now doing what the legal people are calling an out-of-court settlement. So we were appointed by the minister. So in that task team, the membership is National Health, which is caring, and then National Health Laboratory Services and KZN Department of Health. But in that task team, they don't come in their caps. So we are a task team that is trying to resolve the matter. So, and the other participant is the Accountant General's office, because they were requested by the National Health Department to go into the issues that actually led to the dispute between the two parties. So that has been done. The work from the Accountant General has been done and concluded. They will be going to KZN to do a closed-in exit meeting to actually now hand over the report to KZN Health. And as I speak, or probably it has already happened, the Accountant General's office has been requested by the ExCo of KZN to present the findings to them. So our mandate, Chairperson, is to present our work to the minister, and the minister will finalize on the recommendation. So I cannot give the details of the recommendations yet, because we need the minister to pronounce or approve them. Then we will make them public.
By end April.
Yeah, well, the deadline that the minister had given was end of April. Sorry, the first timeline was end of March, and we met that.
Yeah.
So the report is with the minister. He received it yesterday. And then he will apply his mind, and then give it an approval. Once he has given us an approval, we will communicate back to the task team and then back to NHLS, because there are specific recommendations that will apply, or that will have a direct impact on the manner in which NHLS is going to function from the day the minister signs off. Certain things will drastically change. Yes. So that's where we are.
Thank you very much, Annie. No, ours was to see that there is movement in that particular direction without going to court.
Yes.
I think some of us, we fear court. We don't want anything to do with legal people. We just want to settle things before they go to court. So as long as there's progress, and obviously it's the minister who's supposed to look at it. You said something about the cabinet wanting to sit. They'll see it after the minister, by the way, not before the minister sits.
Chairperson, there is a preliminary report with specific findings. And this report was, actually, according to the Accountant General's Office, is a final report from their side. Isn't that they will present their findings? Then the department must indicate what they take or how they respond to the report. So the same report that was presented to the National Health Council on the 5th of April, which is the outcome of the report from the Accountant General, was presented to NHL, presented to National Health Council, is the same report that is been now presented to the EXCO of KZN. Yes, based on the request by the MEC of Health. Because, Chairperson, I think it would be proper for me to indicate their interest in this matter. They have a provincial interest in the matter because it involves huge amounts that is reflected as owing. So the provincial government of KZN had put aside money to try and resolve the matter. So they want to know, like you, Chair, and the committee, where are we with this matter? Do we continue putting this money aside, or do we redistribute the money to other things because it's taking forever? So that is their interest in the matter in terms of the financial implications of how much is the debt. Yes, sir.
But
thank
they
you.
Need is other interest is that the premier was the MEC for health when the work is started. So the premier is invested in knowing what's happening.
Exactly.
Okay. Remember, that was just a report about the dispute between KZN and NHL. So it's up to us now. We've got the report from the CEO of safety. So can we interrogate the report?
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the NHLS. We are today talking of the National Development Plan. To what extent do you think your involvement is in this NDP, or how will you involve in it, or what's your thinking around the NDP? You've given us a very, very, very good model. Do you think it will be implementable or at this point in time, or it will take some time, or some parts of it will be implemented while it will be implemented incrementally? NHI districts, are you very busy in the NHI districts, or you are going to have some mobile laboratories to service these districts? Now, CEO, I'm asking you a silly question by saying, do you have adequate intelligence within your unit to ensure that private sector does not abuse the services of the public sector? For instance, specimens from private hospitals being sent via hospitals via public hospitals to the laboratories. Teaching a research, I see your work as being so much that it really takes quite a lot of your time. Maybe I was impressed when you're talking about at least having universities, having a special unit that is dealing with pathology. won't that reduce the amount of burden on your shoulders? Because really your shoulders are so full, are really so full. The other question is, do you also appear in journals, or you appear in journals through collaborations rather than having your own journals? I heard that you work with Africa, or maybe I did not totally hear you saying it, but I think I heard that you work with Africa. Do you have an exchange learning program with other African institutes? I know you might have with Americas and other things, but within Africa as a continent, do you have an exchange program, learning program, both ways, to assist your researchers, particularly because I'm saying particularly because one of the universities in this country got some medal or something for doing very good research. Maybe with these programs, is it possible to do that? Yes, you were right when you say you are breaching the PFMA of 40 days, but I'm sure you went through Treasury to do that, because it's quite a breach. Thank you, Chair, for now.
Okay, Honourable Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry I was a little late, but I heard your explanation about the KZN issue. But I think that finance and lack of finance has been a major issue throughout, with people not paying and not keeping to the agreed times. How confident are you that you're actually going to be able to get a turnaround, that people are suddenly going to have the attitude that we must pay? I think it's going to need a lot of pressure from many sources, but let's just see, you know, certain provinces, but yeah. I was interested to see that the turnaround time for pap smears is lower than that for other tests. And I just want to know why that is, when you consider how serious our maternal mortality rate is and just general wellness. I think we need to do something about that. I think the incidence of cancer is really great. And if it can be detected earlier, it's so difficult to get to deep rural areas. How do you get to people? Is this something that's actually done at primary health care level? And I'm just wondering about an organization that I know about called the Pink Drive. They also have mobile units that go into communities and do screening, I think, for breast cancer. But I think they also sometimes do pap smears. Have we got any sort of a relationship with them? Because I think we need to reach out to others and perhaps help them with funding, then they can actually do the job for us. Let me see what else. And then also the labs were not all accredited. Is this a cost factor, or is it that people just haven't got around to it, or there hasn't been the necessary follow-up and implementation? There's been a lot in the newspapers just recently about the meat scare, and I think people are concerned about what they're eating now. Perhaps they weren't before, and we're told that it's been overplayed. I don't know if this is the case. I know there are religious sensitivities. I don't know that there's much difference about eating a buffalo as eating a sheep or a horse. There might again be sort of sentimental reasons that you don't want to eat rabbits, for example. That I haven't managed to get myself to eat a rabbit, but I eat the rest very happily. Anyway, I'm digressing. But is this something that you are involved with as well? I think we need to keep the confidence of our people, and obviously not only the confidence of our people, but of businesses and people who trade with us. I heard some discussions on the radio yesterday where people are suddenly saying, oh, we're becoming vegetarian, we're not going to eat meat anymore. Now, it may be healthier for them, but there are also business implications. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I don't think you'll have a lot of questions, so we'll finish quite early today. But there are certain things that I would want you to probably try and inform us. You know, there are these forensic laboratories. I know they don't belong to you.
Yeah.
But there is some interest in the sense that when we do oversight, we always hear that the specimens delay whatever that's supposed to happen in court. There's a delay. Are there any suggestions that you could give us? As the people who do oversight, what suggestions would you give to us that, look, this is what can be done with the... We're not talking to the real people that are concerned. We're going to be talking to the department tomorrow, but we've got an interest, because it always comes to our oversight that what's happening with those forensic laboratories. Even with sport, there are some delays in finding out what's happening. And some people get free in court because they say, no, the specimens didn't reach the laboratory. I'm very, very happy that you said your restructuring has not yet been started. We haven't looked at the roadmap. We're going to look at the roadmap and we'll sort of tell you our views. The worry there has been that, are they not going to be retrenching some people? There's always this thing of saying, you know, I'm very passionate about the rural health myself as a person. And in fact, the gap between the rich and the poor, which goes to rural and urban. But it seems as if we're not working towards improving the rural health. I know at a certain stage, the NDP talks about 70% of the rural population will be in urban areas in 30 years to come. But now that they're still there, are we saying that they must die or they mustn't have services because in 30 years they're going to move to town? And not only that, there are no services. And we are told that probably in some way you are closing some of these areas because they are not profitable or for whatever reason. Could you come up with some, what is actually happening so that we could try and stop some of the things, because we still need those services because there are people there. Then it comes to your human resources, the training mainly. I think looking at our populations and the demographics, we still don't have pathologists that are coming from those areas. And most of the pathologists, you find them in the urban areas. Is there a reason why we don't have them in those outlying areas? Is it because of cost, or I know there are some incentives that could be put in. Is it because we don't have money to put up those incentives? Maybe the last one is, there's 4%, you talked about 4% that you need to increase. Is it 4%? Yeah, I think it's 4%.
Okay.
Who's supposed to agree that you can have that 4%? Is it the Department of Health, or Minister, specifically? So that if we are convinced that you need this money, then we can talk to the department and say, department, no, because of these reasons, you need to give this 4%. Okay, NHLS. Okay, Honorable Noble wants to come.
I am sorry. I am concerned, maybe it's because I've got a phobia for horses. With the building which you're occupying, with the horses at the bottom and you on the top section. Hey, is there a way of changing that situation, or it's because of the financial crisis that you have that you cannot have another venue? The other thing is we've got so many laboratories in the country. Are they all accredited that they can do the work well and we can trust them? And, you know, we have confidence in them because we are rural people, we are ordinary people. My blood is taken, I'm told it's sent to the lab, and the lab is not accredited. But I am rural, I will trust that. And somehow it might not be so. there are these non-payments. Are there any contingency plan or contingency plan for non-payment to say then if there is total non-payment, what is the contingency plan for that? TB. Much as we say we've got rural areas which are at the bad end of the stick, but we've got the mines which are one way abusing our public health system, but they don't want to plow back. And yet they are private health. They do that much as they blacksand the water that they're using in the area. And we've got informal settlements, which I think are bigger than the place where they stay. And TB is so rife in those areas. And there's a lot of defaulting that these people get, go to the extent of XDR, TB. And finally, Chairperson, I think we salute those provinces where some of these patients got better and well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's up to the NHLS to answer the question. Thank you.
Okay, Chair, I made a note of the question. So to Honourable Chair and the Honourable Member Noble, the first question was around NHLS involvement in the NDP. We've not been directly involved in the NDP, but what we would do is look at that document in ensuring that our plans, there's alignment between that and the NDP, but we've not been directly involved in that process. So the question around the model for NHLS and whether or not it will be implemented incrementally, as I had indicated, Honourable Member, the model is still in a development phase. So once we get approval from the board and from the minister and from the committee and other stakeholders, then with that we'll have to develop a full incremental plan. The model is really looking at options, so it's not proposing something concrete. The board will decide what is the specific option. So there will be an implementation plan. And without preempting the outcome of it, I suspect some elements of it would be incremental and some elements we would do almost immediately. But I think that's a premature discussion. I think once the roadmap is completed, we can then have the full discussion with respect to that. The NHI districts, and are we busy in it? We actively involved in all 11 NHI districts. So we're part of the task teams that are in place and working with the department and looking at the lab part of it. Now, whether or not they're going to be mobile solutions, etc., part of the discussion is to look at our laboratory footprint in that district. And if there was a sense that the footprint doesn't adequately respond to the requirements for an NHI district, then I think that's where we need to discuss the whole issue around what would be the solutions. Do we need to expand our footprint? What is the role of mobile? And also, what is the role of point of care in that? So if there's a small district clinic in that NHI district, then there may be point of care solutions. But the roadmap process, Honourable Member, considers all of that. It factors in the NHI, etc., in developing a model for the future. Then the private sector and whether or not there's abuse. Chair, the way the model works at the moment is that anyone who presents to a public hospital, for the public patients, the hospital pays for that. And someone who is identified as private and they have health insurance, then that bill we attempt to recover from the medical scheme. So that's the arrangement at the moment. Obviously, a lot will depend. Remember, we don't control the registration of the patient. The registration and the classification of the patient happens at the hospital interface. So long as the patient is classified as private, we would take over the responsibility to collect. But if the patient is classified as public, then there's not much we can do. So I think overall there's much better control now, because tomorrow I'm sure the department will tell you about its plans around improving revenue collection in the hospitals. So there's a greater control on the gatekeeping at the front door of the hospitals now. But if there is any abuse, and there probably would be, but I suspect it's quite small. Then, Chair, I hope, at least Honourable Member, I hope I understood your question about the teaching and research and the time that it takes. So I'm going to interpret your question as whether or not we should be doing teaching and research. Is that the question? Right. So, Chair, throughout my presentation, I talked about the importance of that third mandate or that second mandate. Because in terms of a robust, responsive, affordable and sustainable organization, it actually is teaching and research that informs that process. If we take that out, we're suddenly going to find ourselves as becoming a super sort of lab with nothing that informs the next generation. That's the one part. So I think that taking teaching and research out is not in the interest of NHLS, for the reason that we're going to lose out on innovation, we're going to lose out on developing new assays, we're going to lose out in terms of informing new technology, etc. And people like Professor Perez, who's the Deputy Dean at UCT, if we don't have that relationship with them, we're not going to benefit fully as a service provider, because actually service is informed by what happens in teaching and research. It is an iterative process, but I think the other is important. Right. And the second point is we will struggle to attract and retain staff in a pure service delivery model. Because the glue for NHLS is the pathologists and the technologists and the technicians who come to us to train and then stay on. So if we take away that mandate, I think that glue is gone, and I think that we're potentially going to have a great difficulty attracting and retaining. Now, of course, then the question is, but you're putting a burden on the province because you're building it into your cost. And I think that the way this should happen is NHLS should be seen as the 10th province of the country. And therefore, the teaching and research function should come. It is an unfunded mandate at the moment. It should come as a special grant, like the hospitals get for teaching clinical professionals, doctors and nurses and everyone else. So I think that's the solution going forward. Do we appear in journals, and do we have in-house journals? No, the partnership, there's a partnership between the faculties of health sciences and the NHLS. The pathologists that work for NHLS have joint appointments with the universities, the eight faculties of health sciences, and the schools of pathology are run and funded by NHLS. So we subject ourselves to exactly the same rigor as the university applies for all of its academics. So all our publications, last year when we reported to you that we did 510 publications, they were all authored and co-authored in proper international peer-reviewed journals. We don't have any internal journals at the moment. We compete in the international community for the publications that we do, but it is a partnership between the Faculty of Health Sciences and NHLS. The National Institutes of Communicable Health and National Institute for Occupational Health don't have that relationship, but they will. Any publication that comes out from there is subjected to the same rigor as any of the academic publications. So there's a very high standard that we maintain, like MRC does. And then on the question of the debtor days and the 40 days, now, no, Chair, we haven't gone back to Treasury to get approval for that. I flagged that as an issue because we've used that as an assumption. And the difficulty that we have is we can put in 30 days, but we've never had a situation yet where we've been able to achieve the 30 days target. So at some point, we're going to have to engage Treasury. I mean, it's unlikely that we're going to get any waiver of that, because that's the law, PFMA. So I we're going to have to deal with that if we don't meet the target. And then on the question of the hostels and the buildings, and can we change this? Absolutely. The health conditions are not ideal for our staff. It's creating all kinds of medical problems. We've already seen sick leave patterns get worse. And so the plan is to really move the hostels out. We need the hostels because we do antivenin. And so we need the horses for the antivenom. We're the only provider of antivenom on the African continent, Che. So we need the horses for that purpose. And therefore, we're finding a way in which we can set the stables outside of the where the administrative buildings are. We got some land, and we'll improve that over the next 12 months. Sorry.
Well, then you need to change with Africa.
Right. So then on the question of the learning exchange with Africa, there's two things that happen. So the first issue is we just had a research summit a couple of weeks ago. And at this research summit, we re-emphasized the need for South-South dialogue. We have excellent North-South dialogue. So we have partnerships with the universities in Europe and North America and others. But there's a strong push now to build the South-South dialogue, and in particular, our partners in academic institutions on the rest of the African continent. And in fact, tomorrow I'm at a meeting for 3 days with the African Society for Laboratory Medicine. And that's part of expanding the agenda for an African dialogue. And the faculties of health sciences have the same focus around building there. So we're looking, that's at the one level, that's to do research and service delivery improvement. But the other side is that we also have large numbers, well, not large numbers, but significant numbers of professionals coming from many African countries to train with us in these schools of pathology with the faculties of health sciences. So that is also happening. And with the SADC countries, we have a much stronger relationship. We, in addition to that part of it, we serve as supra-regional laboratories for many of the African continents, many of our African partners. They don't have reference labs for TB, or not as sophisticated reference labs for TB, for HIV, for many of the other public health diseases. So we provide that service to those countries, and we do that in partnership with WHO and the African Society of Laboratory Medicine and with the Ministry of Health. So if there's an outbreak of a particular disease in Zimbabwe and we're called upon to support them, then we do that. So there's a very strong collaboration at that particular level. Then on the non-payment and do we have contingency plans? Now, you'll recall last year when we had that particular problem, we tried to get an overdraft facility, and Treasury, rightly said, no, you must collect your money from the provinces. But having said that, the minister has intervened at a national level, and as you're aware, he's identified the non-negotiables, and laboratory services are one of the 10 non-negotiables. So there's a very strong focus from the perspective of the National Department. I mean, Ian is here, I'm sure he'll attest to that. There's a strong focus now looking at the budgets of provinces, ensuring that they budget adequately, building in their price increases, and on a monthly basis now it's going to be monitored. So we're already seeing the benefits of that. So the contingency plan really is, we're now part of one of the 10 non-negotiables. And I think that's an important shift from where we were 18 months ago. And we really appreciate the fact that the minister has identified that. And then on the question of TB and mines abusing the public health system, there's a discussion now that's unfolding around TB in the mines, as the Honorable Member is aware of. And Dr. Krishnasamy, who is the chair of NIOH, is also now has this role as the acting commissioner for CCOD and MBOD. So we're seeing greater involvement at that side, but also the minister has had several important policy meetings with the mines, and he'll talk to that. But we've been part of that discussion in terms of the laboratory part of it, and how do we respond to the diagnostic requirements. And so I think that the relationship between the mines, the National Department of Health, and NHLS with respect to laboratory medicine is now a very high priority, both from the perspective of the minister and ourselves as the NHLS. So I think we just got to monitor that and ensure that everyone puts in their little bit to deal with the problem collectively. And then on the informal settlements, I agree with you. The issue is that it's a highly mobile population. there's high levels of loss to follow up, defaulting is a major problem. And, you know, again, I think that we just got to collectively put our minds together to see how we address that. But I don't know, Faisal, you may want to comment specifically on the informal sector and the mines.
Yeah. You know, I think it's more than just the member parliament, than the informal sectors in the mines. I think we all realize that since 1994, we've gone up from about 200 informal settlements now to almost 2,500 informal settlements. But the majority of those are not necessarily around the mine. I think what certainly when it comes to healthcare services, the mines need to be held to the regulatory environment to the that the National Health Act introduced some time ago in terms of facilities being accredited. And right now, those mines are not. Because we didn't follow up on that particular part of the statute, the mines are, mine clinics and hospitals don't have accreditation in the country as such. It was an agreement that was reached long before apartheid came to an end. We need to actually revisit that area in terms of NHI, because I think all hospitals really should be negotiated. But the important thing is that we have informal settlements throughout the country, not only in the mining industry. And I think we need to even start looking at that if we're going to, the Department of Human Settlements have said that something like 5 to 7 million of our people live in informal settlements. And if we look at what is available and the staff team that reported on this last year and the meetings that we had in those areas, it showed very strongly that people said they didn't have access to healthcare services. I think we've got to look at it in a much broader way than just talking about, I think it's important around the mines, because mines are the wealth creators of our country. And yet, if we look at the areas around mines, who's living in those areas? It's primarily black people who are living in those areas. And why are we not getting it right? Given that there's a social plan in place, given that we've written new legislation, I'm sure we don't all want to move towards nationalizing the mine. But maybe that's where we're going to go to eventually.
Okay. Chair, let me quickly run through the other questions. Some of it I may have already answered. With respect to the Honorable Member Robinson, I think that the first question was addressed around the lack of finance, and I think it's something that concerns us always, because it does impact on our ability to train, on our ability to modernize and do all of that. But I think with the issue around the identifying us as one of the non-negotiables, hopefully the situation will turn around. But in this regard, Chair, I think it's also important that the extent to which, I know the National Department is putting a lot of pressure, but if there are other pressures that's brought to bear, the conditional grants are called conditional grants because they come with conditions. And so they need to be, that at least should not be a controversial area. The province gets the conditional grants for TB and HIV, and we provide a bill, and assuming that they're comfortable with the bill, those sorts of things should be paid without concern about cash flow and that sort of thing at a provincial level. So that would be the one, just to make the one point. On the question of turnaround times for pap smears, and that they lower than other tests, Member Robinson, the nature of pap smears is that it's a very manual process. So the actual test itself takes a little longer than what would happen in a routine, for any other routine requirement, because a lot of it is automated. It's a technologist who is involved in it, and it requires a lot of manual preparation and then the actual reading of the slide. And it's physically exhausting, and there's only X number of slides you can do a day. In fact, it's 70 slides a day, Patrick, for pap smears. So it's 70 slides a day that they can do. And it's an area where there's a massive shortage of technologists. And so despite the fact that we put in bursaries and we put in other incentives to encourage young people to get into this professional area, it's also not considered one of the easier disciplines to get into, because generally you train as a generalist and then as a technologist in cytology. So it's a difficult area, but notwithstanding that, our turnaround times did slip. In fact, I'm assuming that you're talking to a presentation that I did last year, and we said that we were slipping behind. But we've since restructured. The service itself is a centralized service in about six or seven sites, mainly because it's a scarce skill. But the second side of it is that we work to the requirements. The issue today, Chair, is about what is clinically appropriate. So even if we significantly increased the turnaround time for pap smears, the patient will only come back in 4 weeks' time. So the choice that we have, do you put in massive amounts of money to improve the turnaround time when in fact the next consult is in 4 weeks' time? So it's always that delicate balancing act between, yes, I can get the result to you faster, but if you're not going to do anything with the result, should we be making those investments? So we're constantly talking to the provinces. We've caught up with all of our backlogs now with cytology. But where we can't respond because there are particular problems, then we will contract with other providers to ensure that we get that done for a short period of time. But the key issue for us is that we've got to accelerate the training, and we've got to encourage young people to identify this. It is quite a labor-intensive, and it's also a physically exhausting process, you know, to read 70 slides a day. And then obviously if you make a mistake, it has all kinds of consequences. So people are quite rigorous in their way they do that. But we've since caught up. And the issue around the rural areas and whether or not there's an adequate service, as I had indicated, we don't have a cytology program in rural areas, because we've had to consolidate it around the academic centers and the urban areas, because that's where the cytotechnologists are. And in fact, if we started pushing people to go into rural areas, they'll just go to the private sector, and it's a very small pool of people. So we've looked at improving our logistics. And at this point, Chair, it's important for the committee to understand that where the lab is located is not the issue. It's the speed with which we can get a result back to the patient. So even when we're doing restructuring, etc., if the perception is we're consolidating something and we're moving it elsewhere, the judge is not whether or not we consolidated the service. The judge is whether we're giving a better service than we were doing before. So when we're looking at laboratory services going forward, just keep that at the back of your mind. So at this time I should also let you know that there isn't a single facility in South Africa now, however remote it is, where we don't do at least a daily pickup. At least a daily pickup. There isn't a facility anywhere where we do at least where we don't do at least a daily pickup. Right. So the issue around the pink drive, I must confess, Honourable Member Robinson, I'm not sure whether we do. I'll need to check, and if we don't, then we'll start a dialogue with them. I'm assuming it's an NGO, and then we'll look at whether there are opportunities for us to partner with them in terms of taking the program to rural areas, etc. So I'll follow up on that, and we can come back to the committee.
With regard to the pap smears, researchers at UCT have found a cheap way of detecting cervical cancer without going through the pap smears. We're using simple vinegar tests, and it is about time that we ask the health department to see that this is rolled out, so that there's no need to have so many specimens taken to a lab and the test is You only then need a pap smear for confirmation if you use the vinegar test for to detect abnormal cells.
And obviously, we once this has been evaluated, etc., we'll integrate it as part of the overall cost form that we all think. And then the question around not all labs are accredited, and is this the cost factor? The first issue is it is hugely expensive to get standard accreditation. And with 268 labs, it's going to cost us a lot of money. So what we've done, as I indicated in the report as well, we have internal accreditation programs, and we've also built up this relationship with the CDC, the US CDC, on the TechWise program. So that is a sort of external program, although it's run in-house. So the question that you also raised, Honorable Member, Mulwad, about are the rural areas, are there no quality standards? There absolutely are quality standards. They're internal quality standards, and they're evaluated by the quality department sits outside of the region. So we have a national quality program, and they go out and they will ensure on a regular basis that there are quality standards. There are also specimens and that are sent through to the center to be reviewed in terms of the routine testing that we do. So there's all kinds of accreditation program, and in fact quality is not the concern that I would have in NHS. We're pretty good on the quality side. But we need to accelerate the accreditation of all our academic and regional labs. I think that's where the priority needs to be. But the rest of it, we have lots of mechanisms to ensure that we meet quality standards. But there is a cost factor. On the question of the meat scare, no, we're not involved in that. That would be the agriculture folks. That would they have their own labs to do that. Although I should say that we have food testing capacity. I mean, in Patrick's lab at Greenpoint, we have a whole unit that looks at food testing. But on this specific issue, we're not involved, and we've not been asked to be involved. But last year, when there was the problem with the ostriches, and when agriculture couldn't respond, then they contracted us to provide that service for them on their behalf. So we have the capacity to do it, but at the moment, I think that they're managing that quite well. And then just to wrap up on the last question, Chair, that you have raised, on the question of the forensic lab services. Now, I had reported a year or 2 years ago that the forensic lab services is a national competency, and it's part of the National Department of Health. But in fact, NHLS is ably placed and competent to take over that service. There are some issues around chain of custody, etc., that we need to sort out. But the technical side of it, we pretty much can run, because it's the same pathologist that we have. And so potentially, if the department thought that this was something that NHLS may want to take over, we'd be happy to have that dialogue. So there have been requests of us to support one or two provinces on the forensic laboratory side, but at the moment we've had to keep away because it is a national competency. The act is not an obstacle to taking over the forensic laboratory services, or to provide more support to the labs that are already in place. And I think part of bringing in forensic laboratory services in the NHLS will also optimize the use of the pathologists that we have. Because they have their pathologies, we have our pathologies, we don't have enough, they don't have enough. And the logical thing would be to consolidate and see the benefits associated. But I think that's a future discussion. The restructuring, Chair, I should say that the restructuring has not started, but we have made one change. And the one change is we currently run four regions, NHLS, and this is just an operating model, not a service model. We run four regions, and at the last board meeting we've agreed for us to be more responsive to what provinces want. Because the way our regions are set, in our minds, was slightly problematic. Because we had Gauteng, for example, that split in two parts. One part of Kaltim was managed by one regional exegin, another part of Kaltim was managed by another, and with Kaltim went Free State and Northern Cape, and with the other part of Kaltim went Limpopo and Mpumalanga and Northwest. And we thought that that's not the way in which we should operate because of the, if we want to give more service. So what we've done is we've changed. There's no change in service, but in an operating model that we're going to 6 regions. And the three largest provinces in the country will be a region on their own, and the other provinces will then group to each. So it makes it managerially easier for us to respond to what the customer is. That's the only change that has happened. The rest of it will, as I've indicated, will come much later, once the plans, etc., have been okayed by all of the relevant stakeholders, and of course the most important stakeholder being the shareholders.
The big one, financially or geographically?
The big ones are population wise.
Oh, population.
Right? So it's Gauteng, Eastern Cape and KZN.
Oh.
That will stand as single region with one point of focus, with one manager focusing on that. Then on the rural health and the gap in rich and poor, are we working towards rural health? Again, our focus is obviously to support the minister on restructuring primary health care. But it is important to understand that the lab doesn't have to physically be there for us to provide the service. But within the continuum of point of care to a full lab, we'll have to locate something. And part of the roadmap process is then saying, well, how would we respond to the primary healthcare restructuring challenges? How would we respond to the school health program? So if that's a mobile lab, then those are the kinds of new tools that we need to bring in, or new solutions that we need to bring in to be seen to be supportive to the Department of Health. But again, it largely depends on what is clinically relevant. Because as you know, the primary healthcare clinic is led by a nurse. And so there isn't as much urgency as the district hospital, and there isn't as much urgency as a regional hospital, and there isn't as much urgency as the central hospital. So we'll locate all of that in some sort of continuum. And we're very conscious of the fact that we have to be responding to the restructuring of primary health care. And at this point, we're not saying that there must be pathologists in every rural village. Because one is that a pathologist model is hugely expensive. And so we've got to consolidate it. But one thing is clear, is that we have to move out from these current academic centers and move to the large cities. So there already is significant progress towards, well, I won't say significant, but there's good progress towards moving people into the cities. So if you take the Eastern Cape, for example, we now have pathologists. We've had no pathologists in East London and PE, and now after 4 years or something, we finally have pathologists. So we're moving towards moving pathologists to the big cities, and in the smaller provinces like Limpopo, Mpumalanga and others, we're now looking at getting pathologists in. And part of our policy is that when we train pathologists, there's a work-back policy. So after they train, they have to work for us for 2 years. So as part of that placement, we're moving them into those settings, with obviously the support and what have you that goes with it. So that's the issue around the response to rural. And training of... the pathologist is not coming from a rural area. Now, at this point in time, it will be in our annual report, and I should take the credit then. But this year, for the first time in the history of NHLS, we've had over 100 applicants for under 30 pathologists for the first time. Mm-hmm. So clearly something is happening now that is beginning to motivate people to start exploring pathology as a potential area for specialization. The second part of this, for the first time in the history of NHLS, we've had a majority of African applicants. Majority black, but of that black, the majority have been African applicants. So for this last intake, almost 90% of all trainees that registered that were appointed were in fact African. So, say again.
Mm-hmm.
Now the good thing about pathology is that shift has already happened. So we're seeing a complete feminization of the workforce with respect to pathologists. So we have, well, the majority of the college is actually now women. And certainly those that I am training are women. So there isn't too much concern about the gender issue. But I think that based on the programs that we've done with the faculties of health sciences, we're seeing a turnaround in terms of attracting people. Now, the more fundamental question is about rural, because we still can't get people back into rural areas. So the technologists, we're now actively recruiting in the town or the village where we want people to go back and work. For the pathologists, it's more difficult. As you know, you first have to train as a doctor, and then you become a pathologist. So that part is a little more difficult. But I'm not too anxious about this, because I can't imagine that we're going to have a plan where there's going to be a pathologist in every village. In my opinion, at this point in time, we're not anywhere near sustaining that kind of model. Because remember, a pathologist's salary already starts at around $1 million. Right? So for every pathologist that you hire, you can hire five technologists. So there's, you know, it's going to be an incremental approach, and we'll eventually get there, but there's a strong partnership between the Faculty of Health Sciences and the NHLS to ensure that we get those demographics right. As we sit at the moment, of course it's skewed in favor of primarily white pathologists, but the move is in the right direction, and it's moving at a much faster pace than perhaps 3 years ago. The last intake is telling us that we did something right. And then, who agrees on the tariff? The tariff process is set out in the Act. We determine a budget 6 months in advance. Part of the budget is determining what the tariff should be. Once we've determined it, it goes to the board. The board reviews and amends and approves. Once they review and amend and approve, we write to the minister. And from that point on, the minister has to consult with the provincial agencies for health, the provincial agencies for finance, and the national minister of finance, and then eventually it's approved. Once it's approved, we've got to give the provinces 30 days notice before we effect. So at the moment, we're just waiting to get confirmation of whether or not the tariffs are approved. It's going to be 13-14. So we're running a bit late, but Ian, in fact, is going to follow up on that and let us know. So, Chair, I think I've covered all of the questions.
No, you've covered all of them. Just two last ones. One about the females and pathologists. Right. I think you could add, Segi, that not only from the pathology side, even if you go to the medical schools, there's more females that are doing medicine now than males. I don't know why, but there's more. If you go to these medical schools, there's more females than males, and it's starting from there. It would be very interesting, Segi. It's not your job. But we've been confronting something about regulations about tobacco.
Right.
I'm saying this because they are not journalists now. I mean, one of the questions that has been pertinent, definitely it's not for you, was there have been regulations. There's a law that was passed.
Right.
And after that law, there were regulations.
Right.
And after those regulations, now we want to pass other regulations. Or the department also passes. But the question is, have we got research as to how many people died of cancer? How many people do have obstructive Lewy disease? I mean, laboratory-wise, are things becoming better? Or have they worsened? Before we say we want to, because the problem is, over-regulation.
Yes.
We don't want to over-regulate. But now, if we had regulations in 1996, and then we come again, we want to regulate, without having evidence-based information as to what happened from that time to now. Has it improved? Has it worsened? But we just want to regulate again. But I don't think it's in your court. It's not in your court. It should have gone to Slim. Okay, you want to ask something?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'd like to seize this opportunity and they actually balance the perspective in terms of the impression getting out of this very important session of today, which was really fantastic. And as far as NHLS report is concerned, done by the CEO. I do, however, would like to bring the honourable members to the very critical realities. Without taking too much of the time, Honourable Chair and the honourable members, you've asked, I think, once or twice in respect of the implementation of the transformation process or the roadmap process, as it is referred to popularly. Because of the lack of the information regarding that, the question I would have probably seen is how far involved is that process in respect of the stakeholdership in terms of the acceptance, so that when it reaches the implementation, there is unanimity in terms of that implementation. There is a big problem in that area that I would like to state. The consequences of that problem result in the membership, the constituency, rumbling, that is, speculating. And what then strengthens the speculations is the fact that, very sadly, some of the speculations within the process are actually implemented. And then whatever else is being speculated by the constituency then looks like it will be implemented. Now, why I want to raise it is we are leaving a very good impression, which is I like a lot. But I don't want a situation where in 2 days or 3 days' time down the line, the constituency feels they need to rise. And we were sitting in this room and there was nothing of the sort simmering. The groundswell is looming in regard to that. So if that area is not looked into, we may have to probably be addressing it. Why I raise it at this point is, as decision makers, it would be to our favor to ensure that it is handled quite properly, such that it doesn't get to that stage. I know I may be talking a little bit out of turn in regard to this, but to me it is very, very important that it is brought to the attention of the floor. Honourable Chair, why I'm saying it's because you would realise I'm on the ground. As a regional manager, I'm on the ground. So the pressures that come from the ground, they would hit me. And being less informed myself, I'm unable to address them, which then creates a bigger problem because that then escalates to the level, to the next levels of the cascade. There is a problem that pushed the pressures and my other affiliations pushed me to then have to document some form of a report and distribute. And it's in circulation. It may seem to be out of order, but it is in circulation. And they give it a week or two, the reality of the NHLS is then going to surface. That's what I wanted to put across to the floor.
Can I respond to that?
In our meeting the last Thursday and Friday, the board did recognize that one of the issues with regard to a weakness in the organization is communication. And we have undertaken that is one of the most important things that we are going to address within the organization. And we didn't raise it here today because it is still the discussion of how to do it and when to do it and which stakeholders we need to communicate with first. becomes an issue that we have to resolve before we go out and talk publicly about something that is still in the realm of speculation. There is not a single part of the roadmap that has been discussed that is up for implementation at all. Not a single part. It is discussion. There are proposals being made. And yes, we recognize that those proposals, when it is speculated about, raises issues of uncertainty amongst our stakeholders. But once we have our communication plan, we can go and say, what do you think about this? But if we do that prematurely, people will think their jobs are at stake. People will think that there's instability in the organization, which is not true. The organization is stable, and even as a new board member, I can tell you that. As a new chairperson, I can tell you that the organization is stable. And if there are rumblings, it should come to the board, where the board can then address it adequately. So I'm going to ask Mr. Lukwaba to please address his concerns to me, and I will ensure, I'm promising you, and you can hold me accountable, that I will address every one of those concerns personally.
Thank you. Members, I think we have asked our questions, and we have had answers from it. But there's just something that just came up, but it has been addressed by the board. But I must say, we'll rely on what to say. But we are members of parliament. So working in a very asymmetrical country, and in our constituencies, these things, they come to us. Most of the things that have been mentioned, well, not even mentioned by Lukwaba, they've actually come to us from the constituencies, people telling us that, look, there's this that is going on. Sometimes I had phoned to say, I still have got SMSs that are here of people like Ndlangis. I think it's Ndlangis is in Gauteng,
yeah,
complaining of certain things. They are worrying, and then you get media reports that there was a toy in NHLS. I think it happened once or twice this current year.
Once last year.
So you get those things. But one takes it that leadership is about making sure that you settle things before they get into a situation where they are bad. But we're hoping that you're going to handle this. Nothing is going to happen without without you knowing what is going on, so that we don't get something coming up without having noticed that there was something that was going to happen. But looking at the diversity, and I always get worried in South Africa that we don't know each other. I don't know, somebody might, but we seem not to know each other, but we're getting there slowly to know each other. How, because it's all about perceptions, that this is what I perceive, and coming from this area, and we need to correct those things and communicate. I think communication, as you say, is going to be very important, but we're going to keep our ears on the ground and listen to what's happening, and we'll tell you. I'm hoping that Mr. Lukwaba, you have heard what Deputy Chair is saying, and Deputy Chair. So we'll make sure that we keep in contact, and if there are any problems, but we are always here. If there are things that are not happening well, the way that is expected, I don't think there's anybody who can go to Robben Island. The Robben Island is closed now. So talking what you want to talk doesn't need that you must get permission. You can just tell us that, look, these things are not happening, and we'll handle it. You're not going to go to jail because of telling us some of the things. Feel free to tell us. As long as, you know, what I found in some of the municipalities in my constituency, is that people within the same organization they'll go and talk ill about somebody else with the hope that they're not going to ask the other one what happened, because they want that one to go down in the same organization and the other one to come up because he's interested in power. So the important thing about leadership is to listen from both sides and then take an informed decision as to what's happening. So we'll definitely listen and try and make sure things are done properly. Our being here is to make sure that South Africans get the benefit of what we're trying to do, get the benefit of their taxes. That's the reason why I'm sitting here. Otherwise, if I didn't intend doing that, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be sitting somewhere else and doing something else. But I'm sitting here because I just want to see that South Africans get the benefit, irrespective of who they are, where they come from, what level of economy are they, but they must get the benefit of their taxes in South Africa. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, NHLS.
Thank you,
members, we've got few members, but thank you very much for...